The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you all for coming out tonight amidst all of the current economic and political craziness that's going on. One of the things that I love most about good fiction, and that I hope you do too, is its ability to draw you into another life through an image or a character or a simple turn of phrase, and to hold you tight within that narrative until the turn of the final page. It's not mere escapism, and it's not relinquishing a responsibility to think. The very best novels demand that your brain be turned on and churning away. So how lucky are we tonight, then, to host one of the modern masters of the art of fiction, to be able to listen to her spin a story that simultaneously engages us to ponder, but also perhaps transports us away, even for a few minutes, from some of the more heavy thoughts on our mind. I am delighted. Marilyn Robinson is the author of three works of fiction, Housekeeping, Gilead, and Home, and two works of nonfiction, Mother Country and The Death of Adam. Of her newest novel, Home, A.O. Scott writes in the New York Times Book Review, "It is a book unsparing in its acknowledgement of sin and unstinting in its belief in the possibility of grace. It is at once hard and forgiving, bitter and joyful, fanatical and serene. It is a wild, eccentric, radical work of literature that grows out of the broadest, most fertile, most familiar native literary tradition. What a strange old book it is. So please join me in welcoming the incomparable Marilyn Robinson."
It's wonderful to be here, and I want to thank you all for coming out on this night of nights. I'm going to read from Home. I always seem to me to make my books difficult to read. I don't even think about it until I'm done. But in this case, I have two male voices whom I hear very distinctly in my mind but have a little trouble rendering and making distinct when I read. So I will try and, you know, I hope I don't exaggerate. And the other thing is that I quote from songs, in songs of, you know, various kinds in this book, and I can't sing. So for your enjoyment, I will simply read the words, and you can hum along if you want to. Jack began spending time in the barn again, leaning into the engine of the DeSoto. I should say, Jack is the strayed brother who has returned. Glory is the disappointed sister who has also returned home. Their father is slowly dying through the course of the book. If you've read Gilead, I think you know who they are, and if you haven't, I owed you that explanation. Jack began spending time in the barn again, leaning into the engine of the DeSoto. To work on a car where anyone might see was considered unseemly by the Bowdens, not different essentially from setting it up on blocks. And Jack was aware of the likelihood of failure and therefore careful to provide as little opportunity as possible for anecdote or worse, for offers of help or advice. Glory mused from time to time on how often the starchy proprieties observed in her family overlapped more or less precisely with Jack's strategies for avoiding humiliation. In any case, he spent a good part of every day in earthy, dank concealment, oiling some memory of resilience into stiffened leather upholstery, or sinking inflated inner tubes into the horse trough to find the leaks in them. They had had a horse once, mottled white with a grayish face and stockings. They called him Snowflake for a dingy splat of near white on his brow. He was docile when her father bought him for the first two of his children. There were photos of Luke and Faith as toddlers astride the horse and her father holding the reins. Docile meant old, and in the photos, his weariness and bewilderment are already visible. But in fact, what the photos captured was only the onset, in fact, the spring of a terrible longevity. Even Glory remembered the ancient, moldy horse standing in the barn or the pasture with his legs splayed out, as if he expected the earth to tilt abruptly and was braced for it. It was his misfortune to be a horse, with enough persisting horse-like attributes, for example, a mane and most of a tail, to have, in the eyes of children, a chivalric dignity and romance. So year upon year, the matter of bringing an end to the tedium and confusion of his interminable life could not even be broached. Then finally, one day, he was gone. The boys made horrible jokes about how he had made a run for it, had charged through Gilead, overturning matrons and baby carriages on his way to the freedom of the high plains. They took to calling glue and all that was glue-like snowflake, to the irritation of their father and the bafflement of the younger children. Still, there was something about the fact that there had been a horse in that barn, that his trough still stood by the wall and his bridle still hung from a nail above it, that gave the barn itself a certain melancholy romance. A few motes of straw still managed to scintillate in any shaft of sunlight. It seemed sometimes as if her father must have meant to preserve all this memory, this sheer power of sameness, so that when they came home, or when Jack came home, there would be no need to say anything. In the terms of the place, they would all always have known everything. Jack still had a letter to mail almost every day. He took the letters to the post office at the back of the drugstore. He dressed carefully before every venture into town, jacket, tie, and hat. It was a louche sort of respectability he achieved, she thought, but it was earnestly persisted in, with much attention to the shine on his shoes. He would sometimes tell her whom he had met on the street, if he recognized anyone, or more precisely, if anyone recognized him. He reported brief conversations as if they were heartening, proof of something. Once he said, "I believe I could see myself here. Jack Bowden, honest working man, little wife at home, little child frolicking with his dog, I suppose. Not unthinkable." And sometimes he came back drawn and silent, as if he had been shunned or slighted, perhaps. All those letters and never a word about whomever it was he sent them to, and never a word of reply. One day when she was in the parlor, dusting among the clutter of gifts and souvenirs that crowded the mantel, he said, "Well, Glory, I did as I was told. I stopped by Ames, paid my respects, met the wife." He laughed. "You know, after all these years, he still can't stand the sight of me." She said, "He's a kind old fellow. He was probably just tired. Probably up all night." "No doubt you're right." Then he said, "I'm an insensitive brute for the most part. But if there's one thing I know I can recognize, it's a dislike. If he allows himself such thoughts, he was sitting there on his front porch thinking, 'Here comes Jack Bowden, that son of a bitch.' Maybe, maybe not. Sorry. For what? The language. Never mind." He shook his head. "It's hard coming back here." He opened the piano and touched middle C. "Did somebody tune this?" "Papa had it tuned when I told him I was coming home. Back. That was the first thing he wrote to me, after his regrets and prayers and so on. It will be wonderful to have music in this house again. I haven't played, though. I haven't really felt like it." Jack slid onto the bench. "I can't do it without squinting one eye," he said. He took a sip from an imaginary glass, set it down again, and sang, "When your heart's on fire, you must realize smoke gets in your eyes. I hate that song, she said. I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places. Stop it, she said. He laughed. Sorry. I really am sorry, he shrugged. Limited repertoire. How can you even have a repertoire? You never practiced. I thought playing piano had something to do with being Presbyterian. Nobody told me you could get paid for it. Their father's voice rose from the next room, reedy and perfectly pitched. This robe of flesh I'll drop and rise to seize the everlasting prize. Jack said, I guess that's a hint. And he played the hymn through, embellishing a little, but respectfully enough. And sing while passing through the air, farewell, farewell, sweet hour of prayer. He knew the words, and he whispered them as he played. Well, that always was their father's favorite hymn. Yes, the old man said, and I would also very much enjoy Shall We Gather at the River, or The Church's One Foundation, if you prefer that one. It's all the same to me. And he began rather lustily, Shall we gather at the river, the beautiful, beautiful river? Jack plunged in after him. That was rousing, Jack. Yes, the old songs. I believe I've worked up an appetite. 4 o'clock. Well, I might have a cookie. Jack said, I'll get one for you. Milk, if you don't mind. Jack brought him a plate and a glass. Here you are, sir. His father said, It's always sir, isn't it? Never papa or dad. Some of the others call me dad now. Some of the boys do. It's a habit, I suppose. Do you mind? Oh, no, Jack, I don't mind. Call me whatever you like. It's just so good to hear your voice, to hear your voice in this house again. It's just wonderful. If I could tell your mother, she'd never believe me. He took Jack's hand and stroked it. Jack said, Thank you, sir. It's good to be here. And his father said, Oh, yes. Well, I hope so. That's another matter entirely, isn't it? Yes, it is. He patted Jack's hand and released it. There's not much I can do about it. That's how it is. He said, I know Glory got her feelings hurt. Something terrible. Terrible. He shook his head. Jack looked at her almost as if he had just learned something about her that was not perfectly obvious. Or maybe it was to see her reaction, to confirm his sense of things. How should she react? Her father understood much more than his happiness could abide with, and he was very old. I'll start supper, she said. The next morning, Jack was out in the garden early, cutting back weeds and spading up the soil. The old prairie came back the minute a spot of ground fell into neglect. Suddenly there would be weeds head high, gaunt shafts of plants with masses of tiny flowers on them, dusty lavender, droning with bees. And there would be black-eyed Susan and nettles and milkweed and jewelweed and brambles and some avid vine that wilted in sunlight and broke at the slightest touch, leaving tiny whiskers of thorn in the hand that touched it. The roots they put down were deep and tough. It was miserable work to get them up. And here was Jack outside in the new morning light wrestling weeds out of the ground for all the world as if something depended on it. Glory made a pot of coffee and carried a cup of it out to him. I am working up an appetite, he said. Today I will eat. Tonight I will sleep. He stood the spade in the ground and sipped the coffee. Excellent. Thank you. They saw the little Ames boy in the road walking along with his friend Tobias, the two of them elaborating a tale or a joke of some sort to judge by the laughter. Robbie saw them and shouted, Hey, Mr. Boughton. Jack said, I guess that's me. He handed her the cup and walked down to the foot of the garden. He said, What you got there, kiddo? Is that a baseball? No, he said, holding it up. It's just a ball. Jack said, Close enough. Chuck it here. The boy threw the ball a few feet into the garden. Jack dropped down on one knee in the dirt and scooped it up and made as if to fire it back to him, then lobbed it gently into the road. The boys laughed. Tobias said, "My turn. Let me throw it this time." And again the ball fell into the garden. Jack picked it up, then drew himself up sidelong, formal as a matador, held the ball to his chest in both hands and sighted at Tobias along his shoulder. The boys giggled. Jack lifted his foot, the wind-up, the pitch, and lobbed the ball into the road. They laughed and stamped and shouted, "Do that again," and threw him the ball, but he tossed it back and said, "Sorry, gentlemen, another time. There's work to be done." Tobias said, "Are you his cousin?" And Robbie said, "I already told you he isn't my cousin." And the two of them said goodbye and went off down the road talking and laughing. Jack watched them. They seemed like good kids, nice kids. Then he brushed at the dirt on his pant leg. "I really shouldn't have done that," he said. Glory thought, that strange and particular grace of man's body never seems to forget. Scooping up grounders and throwing sidearm. When her brothers were at home, even Jack would play baseball. That may have been why they were all so taken up with it. Even Jack could be drawn into arguments about records and statistics. He would sit around the radio with the rest of them to listen to the games, and sometimes when he played on a team, he would make a beautiful catch or lay down a perfect bunt, exactly sufficient to circumstance as he never was elsewhere, and there would be a general happiness that included him, for a little while at least. She had forgotten all that. She said, "It's good of you to clear this out. I'd more or less decided to let it go back to nature." He had even cleared the weeds out from the place by the fence where gourds reseeded themselves year after year. "Well," he said, "at least now it will be a lot easier for the birds to find the strawberries." He had always had a kind of hectic high-spiritedness that came over him when he ought to have been sad. And there it was, the strange old glitter in his eyes, the old brusqueness in his manner. What could have made him sad? He brushed again at the smudge on his knee and shrugged and said, "When Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman?" "But you do need some work clothes." "Oh, yes," he said, "bib overalls. I have always admired them." "You know what I mean. Something I could throw in the wash, or you could." He nodded and took out a cigarette and lighted it. He said, "I am a stranger in a strange land. I might as well look like one, don't you think?" "It doesn't matter to me. They're your trousers," he said. "So they are. Good of you to point that out." And he tossed his cigarette and went back to delving. That was a little flippant, she thought. She went into the kitchen to peel potatoes for a salad. After a while, he came into the porch and the kitchen and stood by the door. "I'm sorry," he said. "What for?" "When we were talking just now, I think I may have seemed flippant." "No, not at all." "That's good," he said. "I didn't mean to. I can never be sure." Then he went outside again. When she went out to the garden for chives and parsley, she saw the Reverend Ames strolling up the street. Jack said, "I guess he's decided I'll be around for a while. No point trying to avoid me." Glory said, "Papa's been storing up so many grievances against John Foster Dulles, I was beginning to wonder if he could survive another day without Ames to grumble at." "Then he won't expect us to contribute to the conversation. That's good. I'm filthy." Glory went up to the attic, the limbo of things that had been displaced from current use but were not in the strict sense useless. If civilization were to collapse, for example, there might be every reason to be glad for this hoard of old shoes and bent umbrellas, all of which would be better than nothing, however badly they might fare in any other comparison. Other pious families gave away the things they did not need. Boughton's put them in the attic, as if to make an experiment of doing without them before they undertook some irreparable act of generosity. Then, what with the business of life and the passage of time, what with the pungency of mothballs and the inevitable creep of dowdiness through any stash of old clothes, however smart they may have been when new, it became impossible to give the things away. From time to time, their mother would come down from the attic empty-handed, brushing dust off herself, and write a check to the orphan's home. So, Glory thought, the shirts her father had worn before he began to lose weight and height were no doubt in the attic, too. She found them in a cedar chest, laundered and ironed as if for some formal event, perhaps their interment. They had changed to a color milder than white, and there was about them, beside the smell of time and disuse, of starch and lavender and cedar, a hint of old spice that brought tears to her eyes. She took six of them, the newest to judge by the cut of the cuffs and collars, and brought them down to the kitchen, hoping to get them washed at least before Jack saw them. But he was there in the kitchen, rummaging in a drawer. He closed it. He said, "I was just looking for a tape measure. I thought I might get some chicken wire and fence in that garden." It made her uneasy that he always seemed to feel he had to make an account of himself to her. "I found these shirts of Papa's in the attic. I thought you could use them if you wanted to, around the house. They're good broadcloth." He stepped back and smiled. "What is that? Cedar? Starch? Lilies? Candle wax? Isn't the phrase the odor of sanctity? I would not presume." She said, "I'm pretty sure the odor of sanctity will come out in the wash." And he laughed. "I'll try the effects of detergent and sunshine, and then I'll ask you again. I've put you to a lot of trouble." "It's no trouble." He nodded. "You really are kind to me," he said, almost objectively, as though he finally felt he could justify that conclusion. "Thank you," she said. She decided to walk to the grocery store while the shirts were in the washing machine and her father was content with the new issue of Christian Century. It was time she stopped avoiding ordinary contact with people. If Jack could brave it, certainly she could too. It was a beautiful afternoon, bright, warm, and the leaves still had a glitter of newness about them. She'd almost forgotten weather between her father and her novels and her unaccountable insistence on reading them in the darkest room in the house, excepting only the dining room, beside that tedious radio. The store was almost empty. That cashier was cordial. She started home again through the radiant day with a brown paper bag in her arms, redolent of itself and the cabbage she had bought and the cheddar cheese, thinking she had done herself a little good just getting out. She decided to put Andersonville aside for a day or two. Jack was standing on the pavement with his hands on his hips, looking in the window of the hardware store. There were always two television sets in the window, a portable and a console, and they ran all day test pattern to test pattern. This had been true for years, from the time television was a curiosity. A woman stopped beside him and watched for a minute. She said something to him, and he nodded and spoke, and then she went on. Glory walked up to him and stood beside him. He touched his hat brim, never looking away from the screen. She said, "Is that Montgomery?" He nodded. "Yes, it is." Then the screen showed a tube of toothpaste. Glory said, "Lila told me their church was planning to get a TV set so that Ames can watch baseball. I suppose that means Papa will want one, too." He looked at her. "That's an idea." He took her package from her and they began to walk home. He said, "A portable is a couple $100s, but you could ask him about it." "I could just have them deliver one to the house. If he doesn't like it, they'll take it back." He cleared his throat. "You could do that now." "Yes, I could. Do you want to help me choose one?" Not really. I'll wait here. He laughed. I've already spent about an hour in there looking at them. They all seem to work. So she went back to the store and chose an 18-inch Philco with a rabbit ear antenna. The clerk asked after her father and her brothers and sisters, and after Jack, too. Is he home for a visit, or is he thinking he might stay? Glory said, for brevity's sake, he's just visiting for a while. If she'd said she didn't know what had brought him back to Gilead, the strangeness of his situation would have interested the clerk and the owner of the store, who came out of the back room wiping machine oil from his fingers. Interested them more than it did already. She imagined Jack standing among the bins of nails and tool belts and the ranks of crowbars, unspoken to beyond the ordinary courtesies, seeming unaware of their awareness of him, watching flickering television in that cave full of the smells of leather and wood and oily metal, idle among all those implements of force and purpose, citified among the steel-toed boots and the work shirts. An odd place for a man to loiter who was so alive to embarrassment, so predisposed to sensing even the thought of rebuke. And when he did leave the store, standing on the pavement, looking at the window, at the silently fulminating authorities and the Negro crowds. Well, the clerk told her, the Philco would be delivered that afternoon, and if the Reverend decided to keep it, an antenna would be installed on the roof whenever he gave the word. The owner reassured her on precisely these same points. People had always been eager to accommodate her father and to give even ordinary transactions like this one the aspect of exceptional kindness. So she was obliged to answer every question and to accept every assurance twice at least. They told her that many of the older folks find television a comfort. They agreed that the baseball season was shaping up, and she was obliged to hear a little gossip. Jack had stood a long time with his arms full of groceries when she could finally leave the store. So that worked out, he said. Good, thank you. He let her take a bottle of milk to make the bag less awkward, and they walked home. Jack set the television on a lamp table in the parlor. He plugged it in, turned it on, and moved the antenna around one way and another until a passable image presented itself. Their father came in and sat down in an armchair Jack had turned and pushed into place in front of the set. So here it is, the old man said. We're very modern now. He watched without comment a woman in high heels running back and forth across a stage carrying eggs in a teaspoon while a gigantic clock ticked. Glory said, the news will be on soon, Papa. Well, yes, I was about to say there isn't much to this, but you can hear people laughing. I hope there's money involved to get a grown woman to act like that. The phone rang, and Jack came into the kitchen while she answered it, but it was Luke, so he went back to watch the beginning of the news. He was standing in the middle of the room with his hands on his hips. On the screen, white police with riot sticks were pushing and dragging black demonstrators. There were dogs. His father said, "There's no reason to let that sort of trouble upset you. In 6 months, nobody will remember one thing about it." Jack said, "Some people will probably remember it." No. It wasn't so long ago that everybody was talking about Senator McCarthy, watching those fellows argue. It's television that makes things seem important, whether they are or not. Now you never hear a word about Senator McCarthy. Jack said, "Well, that's important, isn't it?" "I can't disagree. I don't know. I never admired him." Police were pushing the black crowd back with dogs, turning fire hoses on them. Jack said, "Jesus Christ." His father shifted in his chair. "That kind of language has never been acceptable in this house." Jack said, as if he had been about to say more, but he stopped himself. "Sorry." On the screen, an official was declaring his intention to enforce the letter of the law. Jack said something under his breath, then glanced at his father. The old man said, I do believe it is necessary to enforce the law. The Apostle Paul says we should do everything decently and in order. You can't have people running around the streets like that. Jack snapped off the TV. He said, "Sorry, I was just kind of..." "No need to be sorry, Jack. Young people want the world to change and old people want it to stay the same. And who is to judge between thee and me? We just have to forgive one another." After a moment, he said, "But I hope we don't have to argue. I don't like the shouting and I don't like the swearing, especially the swearing." He said, "I know those words don't mean much to you. They do to me. You could respect that." "Yes, sir." Jack stepped away and felt in his shirt pocket for his pack of cigarettes. His hand trembled. He stopped in the doorway and looked back at his father. The old man sat bowed in his chair, his head forward, the deeply cleft nape of his neck exposed under the thin tassel of hair. He might have been praying, but anyone who did not know him well could think he was simply sad and frail. Jack glanced at Glory. "Did I do that to him?" The scar under his eye was white. "He's tired," he said. "I shouldn't have said what I did, but things keep getting worse." "He'll be all right when he's had some sleep." No, I mean the dogs. Fire hoses. There were kids." He gave her that distant, appraising look as if to see the effect of trusting her so far. "Are you thinking of going back to St. Louis? None of that will be a problem for you if you stay here." He laughed. "Oh, Glory, it's a problem. Believe me, it's a problem." He went upstairs, came down again for a book, brought the book back down in half an hour and put it by the radio. He stood in the porch and smoked, and then he said, "Back in a while," and left. She kept his supper warm. Her father could not be persuaded to take even a bite of his. "I have never heard him speak that way. No, he was always respectful, as far as that goes, here in my house. I may have made too much of it. No, it's something I don't feel I should tolerate." When Jack came in, his father was still at the table, brooding over his cold soup. "Don't bother," he said, when Jack offered to help him with his chair. "Glory's here. She will look after me." When she came back into the kitchen, Jack was standing in the porch. He said, "It's nice out here, dark." She went out and stood beside him. He cleared his throat. "Can I ask you something?" "Probably." "It's nothing personal." "All right." "Say you do something terrible, and it's done, and you can't change it. Then how do you live the rest of your life? What do you say about it?" "Do I know what terrible thing we're talking about?" He nodded. "Yes, you do know. When I was out walking the other day, I took a wrong turn and ended up at the cemetery." He said, "I'd forgotten she was there." "She was part of the family." He nodded. "All I can tell you is what Papa would say. He'd say, 'Repent, and then you can put it aside, more or less, and go on.' You've probably heard him say that as often as I have." "More often." Then he said, "Regret doesn't count, I suppose." "I don't claim to know about these things. It seems to me that regret should count, whatever that means. But if you just found out about it, no matter whether I regretted or repented, what would you think of me?" "What can I say? You're my brother. If I were someone else and I knew you and thought you were all right, then what would matter more to that would matter more to me than something that happened so many years ago. Even though I had never told you about it, and I should have told you?" "I think so." He nodded. "You're not being kind." "I don't really know." "Well, I might have a chance. Things could work out." He said, "It will be bad at best, a miserable thing to have to hope for, pain all around. Ah, little sister, it's no wonder I can't sleep." The television set stayed on the lamp table. Jack turned it on for the morning, noon, and evening news and turned it off again if there was nothing about Montgomery. His father ignored it completely. For years before Glory came home and without regard to the occasional pious attentions of family returned for holidays, Lila had gone up to the cemetery to look after the Boughtons as well as the Ameses. Glory noticed a special tenderness toward the first Mrs. Ames and her child, who had passed from the world together so long ago, and toward the other little girl about whom, in that gentle, worldly way of hers, Lila seemed neither to know nor to wonder. Snowdrops, crocuses, jonquils. Jack might have seen late tulips or creeping phlox. That was probably good, Glory thought. She would tell him, if he asked, that the flowers were Lila's, so he would not think they meant endless mourning so much as the wish to somehow compensate a child for missing 70 springs, or perhaps to offer delight to her perpetual childhood. She wondered if Lila would ever tell her what all the flowers meant, except kindness and the love of the lives past and present in which she had chosen to adopt herself, as if finally at home. She would probably smile and say, the soil is better there, or that spot gets more sun. But Glory was pleased that Jack must first have thought how pretty the place was, and then have looked to see who was cared for so lovingly. It must have been some comfort to him, though she knew no comfort was ever sufficient. Maybe great sorrow or guilt is simply to be accepted as absolute, like revelation. My iniquity / punishment is greater than I can bear. In the Hebrew, her father said, that one word had two meanings, and we chose one of them, which may make it harder for us to understand why the Lord would have pardoned Cain and protected him and let him go on with his life, marry, have a son, build a city. His crime was his punishment, which had to mean he wasn't such a villain after all. She might mention this to Jack sometime, if it ever seemed to her a conversation had arrived at a point where she could summon delicacy enough to compare him to Cain. She laughed at herself. What a thought. Glory had kept most of the habits of her pious youth. Morning and evening, she took her Bible out to the porch and read two or three chapters. When the others were at home for the holidays, they would sit around the table in the dining room and one of them would read aloud from the Psalms or the Gospels. Like most of their obligations and many of their pleasures, this was, whatever else, a performance meant to please their father, to assure him that they loved the old life and that they had received all the good he had intended for them. To please him was so potent a motive that it displaced motives of their own, which no doubt would have included piety. During the years she lived alone, she had read the Bible morning and evening with the thought that her father would be pleased if he knew, and also to remember who she was, to remember the household she came from, to induce in herself the unspecific memory of a comfort she had not really been conscious of until she left it behind. Now, back in her father's house, as she read, she remembered the same comfort and remembered as well the privilege of distance and solitude, the satisfactions of that other life. What a strange old book it was. How oddly holiness situated itself among the things of the world. How endlessly creation wrenched and strained under the burden of its own significance. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. Yes, there it was, the parable of manna. All bread is the bread of heaven, her father used to say. It expresses the will of God to sustain us in this flesh, in this life. Weary or bitter or bewildered as we may be, God is faithful. He lets us wander so we will know what it means to come home. What does it mean to come home? Glory had always thought home would be a house less cluttered and ungainly than this one, in a town larger than Gilead or a city, where someone would be her intimate friend and the father of her children, of whom she would have no more than three. Then she could learn what her own tastes were, within the limits of their means, of course. She would not take one stick of furniture from her father's house, since none of it would be comprehensible in those spare sunlit rooms. The walnut furbelows and carved draperies and pilasters, the inlaid urns and flowers. Who had thought of putting actual feet on chairs and sideboards, actual paws and talons? She had dreamed of a real home for herself and the babies and the fiancé, a home very different from this good and blessed and fustian and oppressive tabernacle of boughten probity and kind intent. She knew, she had known for years, that she would never open a door on that home, never cross that threshold, never scoop up a pretty child and set it on her hip and feel it lean into her breast and eye the world from her arms with the complacency of utter trust. Ah, well. Once Jack had come into the porch and found her sitting there reading the Bible, he seemed pleasantly embarrassed and asked pardon for interrupting, and she said he was more than welcome to stay if he liked, so he took the chair next to hers and opened the newspaper, but he leaned over to where she was reading. Psalms, he said. An excellent choice. Yes, she said. Sorry. I'm almost finished. She could feel that he was aware of her, restless enough to distract her, so she put the ribbon to mark her place and closed the book. He recrossed his ankles and rustled the paper, so she said, "What is it?" "Oh, sorry. Really just a sort of interest, I suppose. In the fact that you still do that sort of thing, that you always used to do. Not that I wouldn't expect you to, I don't mean that. In fact, I'm always a little surprised by things I would have expected when they happen, if that makes sense." "I think it does." "Do you still pray?" He gestured at the floor. "Down on your knees?" She laughed. "None of your business." "I remember when you were little, you'd kneel by your bed and close your eyes and whisper things into your hands, secrets Hope's cat threw up on the rug. Johnny said a bad word. And we would sit there and listen to it all and try to be very serious about it." He laughed. "You listened to my prayers?" "Hope did, and Dan. I heard them laughing about it, so I came in a few times." "I can only apologize." "No point in it. The damage is done. The Lord will use the information as he sees fit come judgment." She said, "I'm surprised you remember so much." He shrugged. "I lived here too." "All I mean is that when everybody comes home for holidays, we go over the old stories again. I doubt that we would remember half of them if we didn't remind each other 3 or 4 times a year." "I've thought about this place. Sometimes I've even talked about it." There was a silence. Then he said, "So, are you going to try to save my soul, little sister?" "What? Save your soul? Why would I do that?" "Why not? It seems like a genteel occupation for a pious lady. I thought you might want to do me that kindness, since you have a little time on your hands." She looked at him. He was smiling. She knew him well enough to know that he smiled when he thought he might offend, whether intentionally or unintentionally. He could seem to be laughing at himself or at her. She said, "I'd be happy to oblige, but I have no idea how to go about it." "Well," he said, "I'm willing to confess to a certain spiritual hunger. I believe that's usually the first step, so that's out of the way." "And then?" "Then I think it is usual to ponder great truths. That has been my experience." "Such as?" "The fatherhood of God, for one. The idea being that the splendor of creation and of the human creature testify to a gracious intention lying behind it all, that they manifest divine mercy and love, which sustains the world in general and is present in the experience of, you know, people whose souls are saved. Or will be." After a moment, he said, "It's possible to know the great truths without feeling the truth of them. That's where the problem lies, in my case." He looked at her. She said, "I'm flummoxed. I'll have to give this some thought." "Yes, well, it is a lot to spring on you, I know. I always nourish the suspicion that pious folk are plotting my rescue. Now and then it has been true. Not so often, really. But you are my sister, so it seemed worthwhile to inquire, just to save time. He smiled. She said, I think I like your soul the way it is. He looked at her and laughed, and his color rose. Thanks, Glory. That's no help at all, but I do appreciate it. I really do. Have I left time for questions and answers? Okay.
Hi. First, I just want to thank you for writing these books. They're wonderful. I was wondering, the last two books you write a lot about the inner workings of pastors' families. And I don't know, I'm a pastor's son myself. And I was wondering where you get your inspiration or your kind of knowledge for the inner workings of those families.
You know, I'm always gratified when the pastor's son, the pastor's daughter in the audience says that I have insights into these things, because I really don't deserve to have insights into them. I'm a very church-going sort of person, and apparently I've been paying a lot of attention.
When you finished Gilead, did you have the intention to write about Jack coming home?
I didn't. I really didn't. I had actually, there's a book that, you know, almost always I'm going back and forth between fiction and nonfiction. There's a nonfiction book that I was extremely serious about writing. The idea of a sequel was very disturbing to me. I don't like that idea, you know. But these characters kept sort of insisting, they kept being so strongly present in my mind that I thought, why am I denying them their lives? They want their lives, you know. So I wrote the book.
I wanted to ask what you thought your limitations are as a fiction writer in particular, and which of your novels was most challenging?
Well, I don't know. I kind of find my limitations by writing. You know what I mean? When I write what I've written, and then when I look at somebody else, I realize that there's a whole, you know, there are other universes entirely that, you know, that my imagination has not wandered into. I don't worry about my limitations particularly. Just interested in seeing what I can do. I'm always surprised by efficacy rather than by inefficacy, which never you know, not a novel experience. I don't know. I think that probably writing Housekeeping was hardest simply because the idea of writing that at that length was shocking to me in a way, you know.
Thank you. Housekeeping was such a wonderful book, and it's very rare for a book to translate into a fabulous movie as well. Were you happy with the movie? I thought it did do a good job. Were you happy with the movie, and is there any plans for movie versions on Gilead or Home?
Well, I think that the minute that you publish a book that gets any significant attention at all, the movie thing starts bubbling around and doesn't necessarily mean anything. The film of housekeeping I'm very fond of because it was such an honorable project on the part of the people that made the film. Bill Forsyth, who was the director and producer, spent years of his very valuable time just trying to put financing together. And it was a great struggle for him because the usual sources of financing wanted him to, for example, write in an affair between Sylvie and the sheriff. So he had to make the film finally on quite a small budget, and that limited many choices that he would otherwise have made differently. And I think all in all, given those kinds of limits, it's just an utterly brilliant piece of work and a charming movie, a good movie in its own right.
Could you tell us about your process of writing? Do you get up every morning and write a little bit? Do you do it all in one stint? You know, you.
Well, you may have noticed I am not a prolific writer. I think that rumor has circled broadly. I only write when I have something on my mind that feels like a novel, and that doesn't happen often. I write nonfiction, of course, and that's a different kind of thing. But if I try to write fiction when I am not in that specific state of mind, it just goes badly, and I hate it, and it only hurts my feelings. You know, I wouldn't think of publishing it, so my method is not methodical at all. I'm not a good example to anyone.
Would you tell us something about the 1950s? Why did you choose the 50s? And in this time in particular, what can we gain from coming to understand the 50s?
Well, the 50s were certainly complex. I mean, you could write 1,000 novels about what was going on nationally and internationally in that period, which was like every period, contemptible and brilliant and, you know, idealistic and disillusioned and everything all at the same time. But in the first instance, I placed Gilead in that period because I wanted it to be chronologically possible that the narrator would have known someone that was actually active in the abolitionist movement. And so that, you know, that necessarily sets it back. And then, of course, Home took its chronology from Gilead. And so I basically, but that I do notice the coincidence that housekeeping is always also set in the 50s. I like that period, I think, because it's modern in so many senses. So many issues were bubbling then that are still issues that we deal with now and so on. But there wasn't all the clutter. There wasn't all the noise. You know, people couldn't call you up wherever you were at any time of the day or night, you know. Television was much more tentative and basically kind of people playing combs and showing each other trained dogs, you know, that sort of thing. And it seems to me as if there has been, I think there's a problem of language that has been created subsequently, created for us now, in the fact that language is so obsessively recycled and that it takes on so many connotations. You know, I mean, like, frankly, I have trouble with the word values because it's gotten to mean something very narrow and a little tendentious rather than something broad, as I think that it actually ought to etymologically, you know. There's a kind of overuse, kind of too many handprints on almost any word that you hear used in a contemporary context. If you ignore that, you're ignoring a huge burden of experience, using the word burden consciously. And if you use it, then you're in that trap, that spin cycle of unacceptable cliché. So I just sort of step back and decide that I'm not going to deal with that. There is so much language in the atmosphere now that it's like somebody else is writing your lines, you know, and I can't stand that.
How you doing? Thank you. I've read a little bit of your nonfiction as well as your fiction, and I think the thing that's popping into my head is the one question is, I'm kind of wondering, do you approach your fiction to have like a kind of didactic function for you? Like, do you approach it the same way maybe you would an essay? Or not the same way, but are you hoping that some of the same kinds of messages get across?
Well, I sort of think of it this way. I mean, my essays are critical, typically critical of, you know, like I just criticized language, for example. I like human beings, and I feel that their interests in all sorts of ways are not being appropriately tended to now. I utterly accept human fallibility. I know we make a mess of everything we touch and all the rest of it, but still, we're the greatest thing in the universe. No question about it, you know? So, in a way, I feel as if my essays have a sort of protective intent. I would like the atmosphere in which human beings to be more friendly to their thriving and more attentive to their glories, you know? Thank you.
Many of the reviews of Holm have kind of drawn the allusions to the parable of the prodigal son. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering in your writing, particularly with Holm, if you see it as a kind of homage to a lot of those biblical parables, and if that's intentional on your part, or if you're kind of improving on those narratives, or if it's just kind of a...
I have many aspirations, but not that
one. Well, improving not in the sense of, you know, doing better, but, you know...
Yeah. In a way, yeah, I mean, certainly the prodigal son hovers behind this, and that simply is such a powerful parable that I think it just has imprinted itself on my consciousness. But one of the things that's interesting about the parable of the prodigal son in the Bible, and also the way that the way that this book is interpreted, forgiveness is not the issue in the parable of the prodigal son. I mean, everybody talks as if it were, but it's not. If you read the text, you see that the prodigal never thinks of asking for his father's forgiveness. He rehearses. He says, "I'm not worthy to be called your son. I will let me be one of your workmen." You know, the father sees him coming and runs to embrace him before any word has been said. There is no question of whether or not the prodigal will be accepted back by his father. And the father and the son never ask for his forgiveness, you know. It's not a parable about forgiveness. It's a parable about grace, about the fact that you do. In this theologically ideal world that Jesus is describing, the fact of being the son is the only relevant question in terms of how the father will relate to him. And, you know, in other words, grace is like the love of a loving father that doesn't make conditions and doesn't wait to be acknowledged as generous or as forgiving or anything else, you know. It is so characteristic of people to have, if they've heard sermons on that, 99% of the time it's a sermon about forgiveness. But that's not what the parable is about. And so, you know, I mean... The people read this book, can Boughton forgive his son? Can Boughton not, you know, well, does he not forgive his son? That's not the issue. It really is not the issue. It's more, this is a human analog for the parable, and the parable is, you know, the part of the story that is not in the Bible is that the prodigal comes home and then there he is, you know. And then there's also the fact that this makes... I mean, there are lots of other scriptural allusions in here beside that one. And what I mean, Jack is, because of Jack's situation, he's a kind of radical criticism of this solemn, deeply resolved world that he steps into. Because, you know, I hate to do this kind of thing. I sound like an English professor, but you'll notice in Gilead, Ames has a dream that he's preaching, and then Jesus walks into the church, and suddenly he's humiliated by the inadequacy of what he's saying, you know. And this is sort of like, in a certain sense, that critical presence stepping into a world and putting all its value in question, which is, I think, simply the way one lives in the world conscientiously and not the specific implication of hypocrisy or anything like that, but just that the worlds that we make, even at the best, are too small, and there is always somebody that can step into the room and make the smallness apparent. Never tell anybody I said that.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.